Hear, hear, with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.
Well, here we go then. Here, episode 14. A man who needs no introduction, but he's going to get one because, well, it would be a bit of a dull introduction without, wouldn't it? He's Nigel Farage. People no longer need to say, who are UKIP? Because most of us, particularly after the local elections, know. Here has an in-depth interview with the man who once asked the European president, who are you?
I'd never heard of you. Nobody in Europe had ever heard of you. I would like to ask you, President, who voted for you?
Hear, hear, with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.
Well, it all kicked off with Maastricht. Well, not exactly, but certainly the biggest headache for Margaret Thatcher has become a bit of a headache for the current Prime Minister, David Cameron, as the subject of Europe tears his party apart. Remind you of history at all? Nigel Farage is the UK Independence Party leader, former Tory yourself.
Yes, I was. I mean, if I became disenchanted before Maastricht, for me, it was exchange rate mechanism. Mm-hmm. When John Major was Chancellor, signed us up to shadowing the Deutschmark as a precursor to us joining the single European currency. And I thought, do you know what? I can't vote for these guys anymore. So I've been a non-Tory now since 1990.
Why did he do that, do you think? John Major, is he really a Europhile?
Well, they're all Europhile to a certain extent. Mm. I mean, they've never taken us fully into everything because they know British public opinion wouldn't live with it. But, you know, John Major believed in our membership of the European Union. He did later on win an opt-out for us on the single currency at Maastricht because he'd been so badly burnt, I think, by the experience of putting us in the exchange rate mechanism. But whether it's him or whether it's Cameron or, you know, I don't know who it is, every single one of our political leaders for over 40 years has believed that membership of political union with Europe is central to British politics. And I think they're all wrong.
And actually, the public, looking at polls, are incredibly Eurosceptic. Now, the argument that politicians will put forward is, well, if there were a vote tomorrow, people wouldn't understand the issues.
Well, that's the sort of patronising guff we get from our politicians, which is probably why we despise them as much as we do now. I mean, the only argument that has any resonance with British people, I mean, they've made their minds up about where we should make our laws. The scare tactic, and Blair used it, Brown used it, Clegg, Miliband and Cameron now use it, is if we weren't governed by Herman Van Rompuy and swearing allegiance to this new wretched flag, they wouldn't buy any widgets from us. And all trade would cease and barbed wire would go on the beach at Dover and we'd be cut off and we'd be a little isolated island that would head back to living in caves. I mean, that's the best argument they've got. Last Sunday, I was coming up the M20. It was late and there was an accident and I was stopped for quite a long time. And I was surrounded by hundreds of lorries. And they came from Lithuania, they came from Poland, they came from Germany, they came from France, and they were all goods from Europe, manufactured there, being sold in Britain. And do you know something? Whether we're part of political union or not, those lorries are going to keep coming and trade will go on regardless.
So then why do the Conservatives, or at least the Conservative leadership, disagree with your view that we do need to be part, in their worldview, of this single market?
Well, they have a different view. They are happy for us to be part of political union. They are happy for 75% of our laws to be made somewhere else. They think we exert influence. They think we have a bigger presence on the world stage. I think they're completely wrong.
Look, Nigel, can you explain that? You say 75% of our laws.
Yeah.
For non-politicos, can you just explain the breakdown and the EU commissioners and how that interacts with our parliament?
Well, let's bring it down to more sort of bread and butter life, everyday issues. Let's take immigration. Huge issue in this country. We now have zero control over who comes into our country from the whole of Eastern Europe, and that will extend to Romania and Bulgaria next year. Take employment legislation. There are 4.5 million small businesses in this country. They provide 60% of the jobs in the private sector. They are, as I've said before, the heroes of a nation, because these are the men and women, you know, who work their socks off, who borrow money from the bank, who take risk. Mm-hmm. Every single piece of employment legislation actually puts them off employing school leavers, and yet, even if all 650 of our MPs thought we should change employment legislation, there's nothing we can do about it because European law is superior to ours. Take health and safety at work. Well, you know, I don't want to put children up chimneys. I'm not advocating.
Well, 48-hour working time directive applies to people in the NHS, something which is argued actually puts patients at risk.
Please don't get sick at the weekend. because the European Union has guaranteed you will not get looked after properly. Look at what's happening to our landscapes and our seascapes, being despoiled by these disgusting wind turbines that don't work anyway. Why is it happening? To meet objectives decided in Brussels. And you go through our fishing industry, our farming industry, now the entire city of London, Britain's biggest industry, and that's not all bankers, by the way. Sure. There's insurance people, and I'm an ex-commodity guy myself. And all of that's now decided somewhere else. So you get to a point where increasingly, when you vote in a general election, you're not really putting a new government into number 10 Downing Street. You're voting for a change of management. And the UKIP message is, for good or bad, we should govern our own country through the ballot box. General elections should matter.
John Moss is Conservative Councillor for Larkswood. He's tweeted us at Hear Hear Show, if you'd like to get your questions in for future episodes. He says the Conservative Party in Parliament is the most EU sceptic it has ever been and pass the EU referendum bill. Why does UKIP bother?
Really, John, that's interesting. Since the coalition took power, despite a manifesto pledge to do the opposite, under William Hague, this government has signed up for the European External Action Service with the ludicrous Baroness Ashton in charge. And Hague himself now says that we must speak with one European voice on many attitudes towards foreign policy. During this coalition government, we've transferred total control of Britain's biggest industry, financial services, to the charming, unelected Monsieur Barnier and three new European regulatory authorities. And John, it was only 18 months ago that when there was a debate in Parliament about a referendum, David Cameron three-lime whipped his own MPs to vote against there being a referendum. And of course, he's changed his tune a bit, but I'll tell you why he's done it.
Yeah.
He's done it because UKIP are changing British politics.
Do you know, there was a funny thing, and I have to say, George Eustace, I have to say, he's a nice fellow. I'd even say he's a mate of mine, to be honest, but he was the MP who laid an amendment on that bill. And bizarrely, I mean, he's David Cameron's former press secretary, we need to note that. He abstained on his own motion.
Yes, I know. I mean, they're all over the place. If you talk to Conservative MPs and MEPs, there are some who, like UKIP, would say, it's time we got our country back, it's time we had a trade relationship with Europe, but weren't part of the political union. But the vast majority of Tory elected officials in this country believe we should be part of that union. And frankly, there isn't much between them, Labour and the Lib Dems.
Jay Basson has tweeted us. He says, will UKIP dissolve if we leave the EU?
I wouldn't have thought so, because UKIP isn't just about Europe. UKIP is about
really?
In this country. It's about smaller government. It's about more individual liberty. It's about helping small business.
Yeah, but is it really, or is part of that being the early criticism when, you know, within my time within the industry and yours within politics, people said you're a single-issue party.
Parties?
Really?
Well, the Labour Party, when it was formed, was completely a single-issue party. Mm. You know, parties, when they begin, start with a simple core message and set of values and beliefs.
Yeah, but UK Independence Party, it just wouldn't... The label surely wouldn't work. You'd need to rename yourselves.
I don't see why. I want to be independent of Europe. I want county councils to be independent of Westminster. I want individual voters to have much more freedom and liberty in their lives. No, the independence theme works.
OK, fair enough. Well, I want to move on to a topic that might get you a little bit hot under the collar. OK, you're a politician and there would be a political answer to this question.
Oh, don't call
question.
Me that.
I'm afraid you are.
No, I'm a businessman. I'm a businessman in politics.
Did it ever make you uncomfortable being a politician?
Sean, I am not a career politician. You know, I didn't go to one of those Oxbridge colleges. I didn't become a researcher. Unlike most people on the front benches, I've actually had a job.
You're fine, but you're a politician now, aren't you?
For the moment.
Oh, interesting. So if we got EU independence, come on, I need this new look.
Well, I don't think I'm going to be in politics when I'm 65.
Right.
You know, I'm nearly 50. I want to get Britain out of the European Union. Mm-hmm. I want to be part of a process that sets this country on a course to re-engaging with the rest of the world, to making our relationship with Europe about trade, and to getting government off the backs of people. But I don't think anybody can be party leader of any party forever. You know,
you tried to give it up, you're back now.
Well, I did, like Alex Salmond, actually. He did exactly the same thing.
Sure.
I won't do this forever, but my instinct... When I wake up in the morning, I don't say to myself, I'm a politician, I'm a campaigner, I'm a crusader.
Perhaps we should start a new organisation called Politicians Anonymous, I think. It's something we need to look at.
It's a good idea.
I was going to ask you about David Cameron.
Yeah.
And let's just quickly, for Hear Hear listeners, recap. Once upon a time, not too many years ago, this is what he had to say about UKIP.
I mean, UKIP, it's just a sort of, bunch of... Uh, They're just trying to make a bit of mischief. I mean, as far as I can see...
Give us a bunch of what?
Well, fruitcakes and loonies and closet racists, mostly.
Well, we have got the leader of the Fruitcake and Closet Racist Party, Nigel Farage, sort of... you're not even seething about that anymore. I'm going to come and talk to you about that. But let's listen to a very different David Cameron after your, has to be said, success at the local elections recently. From Contempt, this is where he currently stands.
It's no good insulting a political party that people have chosen to vote for. Of course, they should be subject, and they will be subject to proper scrutiny of their policies and their plans. But we need to show respect for people who've taken the choice to support this party, and we're going to work really hard to win them back.
Well, that's a bit of a U-turn. I think Stirling Moss would be proud of that one.
It drips with insincerity, doesn't it? He doesn't mean it at all. He absolutely hates us. He's one of those people who...
You're not being unkind there. Could he not
good
think...
Lord, no.
Well, you know, wait a minute. He's realising that he's losing voters. He's got Linton Crosby.
Yes, he's realising he's losing votes, absolutely. Yeah. And that's why he's changing his tune, because he realises that every time they abuse us, it helps us. And
of course, I want to go on to, Nigel, because people know this. You know, you speak eloquently on the topic. David Cameron speaks eloquently. I'm asking your personal view as a person now. What do you think of David Cameron?
I think he's lived in a very narrow set and social circle, and I think he finds it difficult to mix with people from outside that circle and to accept that other people have valid opinions.
Do you like him?
I don't dislike him on a personal
level. On a personal level. We're totally personal.
I don't dislike him on a personal level. You know, I'm sure he's a very decent human being, but I do think he is somewhat aloof, and I don't think he actually understands how most ordinary people in this country live.
Yeah, is he a man with whom you could do business, if you get my drift?
No, because I don't believe a word he says. Everything he says is engineered.
You think he's a liar?
I think everything he says is engineered to make sure that his political career advances, and that's what really matters. You know, the one thing David Cameron really believes in is having the keys to the door of number 10.
You think it's as simple as that?
Yes.
OK. Well, there is a convention in politics. You are a parliamentarian in the European Parliament, where obviously the word liar can't be used. So I'll ask you a direct question here. Do you believe that David Cameron has been dishonest on the topic of Europe?
No, I think he's been dishonest on many things and quite deliberately.
Do you think he's been dishonest on the topic of Europe?
Utterly. Utterly.
Really?
I give you this cast iron guarantee.
Yeah, but that was the Lisbon Treaty.
But if I become Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, there'll be a referendum on the Lisbon Treaty.
Fine, but he did.
And then he broke his promise.
Yeah, but you've got to be fair about this one, Nigel, because they didn't actually have in mind that the Lisbon Treaty would have been signed by then.
They prayed it would be.
There was a deal
they prayed it would be. Don't forget, Harold Wilson gave this country a retrospective referendum on the Treaty of Rome. Cameron could have done exactly the same thing. They used that cast iron guarantee as a calculation, hoping and praying that Lisbon would have been ratified by the time he became Prime Minister, so that they could say, sorry, no deal. And he's done that on a whole host of issues. And I think the biggest problem that Cameron has got now with voters is not that people think he's broken his word, it's that people are beginning to think he never meant any of it in the first place.
Another question then, and listeners can read into this. Do you wish there wasn't a parliamentary convention where politicians couldn't call others liars?
I don't actually engage in abuse. You know, I mean, I'm rather well known for saying to the President of Europe that his tailor wasn't very good, and he wasn't the biggest...
It was a bit naughty, that, wasn't it?
It was a little bit naughty.
Ian Hislop pulled you up on this on Have I Got News For You. You told him a few words. He said, well, it was more rude. In retrospect, I know what you're trying to get at, but do you accept maybe you were a little bit... You know, offhand, you just get your wrist wrapped a little bit.
Well, you're encouraging me to call people liars in this interview.
Well, I might be doing that.
All I did was to say his shirt hadn't been ironed properly. No, I was teasing him, and it was a little bit naughty, but I've never been abusive and rude about
it. Are you
people.
A bit sorry now, though, just in terms of the way that, you know, it was perceived, the fact that he had done with you?
I think that for me to say to a man who'd just been made president of 500 million people on a salary bigger than Obama's, who'd not been elected and therefore can't be removed, and whom nobody had ever heard of in this country, to say, who are you, I think was fair game.
Fair enough. Well, let's get another opinion on this one, the doyen of fairness, it has to be said. Tony Grew is the parliamentary editor of Dodd's Politics Home. Tony, do you think Nigel was speaking his mind or maybe just being a little offhand?
I think that Nigel was doing what Nigel does best, which is generating headlines and also, you know, speaking his mind. It's one of the things that people really appreciate about him, and I think it's one of the reasons he's such a popular politician.
OK, well, it's quite a nice little...
It wasn't bad,
flattery,
was it?
Was it?
Yeah. And actually, if you think about it, I mean, in the House of Commons every week, there is that sort of Punch and Judy show, and in other parliaments like Australia, they call each other all manner of things. The irony I think, Tony, with what happened to me, was that I was fined €3,000 for saying that. And when I was hauled over the coals by the president of the European Parliament, he said, Nigel, you can't speak to Mr. Van Rompuy like that. He's not an elected member. I said, I know. That's the point I was trying to make. There's no sense of irony in Europe at all, believe me.
I mean, that is a slightly ridiculous situation. And I think what Nigel's articulated there is what a lot in our political class don't want to say, which is this efficiency elected way in which the European Union wields its power.
Yeah, well, it's and in fact, but isn't this debate now being had north, south, east and west in Europe? And I personally think that the growth of the five-star movement under Beppe Grillo in Italy is the most fascinating development. You know, a country in which there'd been no Eurosceptic opinion of any kind at all, and suddenly he got 25% of the vote. So I think big change is coming in Europe, I really do.
It probably is. But I mean, Tony will testify, speaking to backbenchers I have over quite a few years now. There's definitely a sea change in how you're viewed amongst backbenchers. And anybody who's even got the slight hump, who's on the disaffected right of the Conservatives, at least, you know, has the dream conversation over a pint. Oh, what would life be like in UKIP? That's a fair reflection, Tony.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the UKIP effect is something that a lot of Conservative MPs in particular are feeling in their constituencies. Those of those smaller majorities and the like is obviously something that concerns them. It's also an issue for MPs too. And the same sort of group of voters that we're talking about, it's people that feel that none of the three main parties are articulating what they feel and what they want to talk about. Now, how that translates into the first-past-the-post system that we have here at Westminster will be interesting. The next big challenges for Nigel's party are next year's European elections, next year's council elections. I think there'll be a lot of concern, particularly among the Conservatives, if, as expected, UKIP become the largest party representing the United Kingdom.
Do you think, Tony, that a more positive result than at the council elections would see some movement on progress with the EU referendum? Obviously, it's difficult for David Cameron in the coalition under the agreement that they have with the Liberal Democrats.
Well, yeah, I mean, David Cameron's position on referendums isn't a happy one. Mm. And, we've been here before with promising referendums. And personally, I don't think it's a brilliant strategy to go to the electorate and say, we will have a referendum if you vote for us, if we get a majority, if we can get the legislation through Parliament. So, you know, I think the European referendum idea for David Cameron, it made sense in terms of party management.
Nigel, picking up on what we were talking about, the fancy talk of politicians defecting. Broadly speaking, how many Conservative politicians have come to UKIP or to yourself and said, yeah, I'm at least interested in having a chat?
Every single week, there are councillor defections happening up and down the country.
Yeah, but in Westminster,
and
they're coming. Councillors changed.
And they're coming from Labour too, which is a point very well worth making. I have to say that defections are not my priority. If sitting Tory or Labour MPs want to come and join us, that's lovely.
Nigel, this is a brilliant answer to a question I didn't ask you. What I'm looking at is the number of parliamentarians within the Conservative Party or elsewhere who've spoken to you actively about defecting.
I can't remember now, Sean. It's all good. It's all very sweet.
Tony, do you think he's taken this politician's answer a bit too well?
No. The answer is Stuart Wheeler, our party treasurer, he's the guy that takes people out, wining and dining.
Mm. Does he do that a lot?
Every day.
With parliamentarians?
With parliamentarians, journalists, you name it. But you know.
Well, I haven't been invited.
Well, we'll sort it out.
You better have.
We'll sort it out, don't worry. I mean, as he says himself, he has had, a serious conversation with seven or eight current sitting Conservative MPs.
Wow.
The Cameron speech in January on the referendum, if he hadn't done that, he was on the verge of losing some people. Of that, I've got no doubt at all.
Tony, you wanted to come in.
Nigel's right that Mr. Cameron's speech has won back a part of his party that were extremely disaffected with him. But my other point is, I don't approve of defections. I don't think it's right for people to just cross the floor.
Churchill was a defector, have you know?
It needs to be a by-election to confirm that choice with the people. Mm. I do, my personal view is that it's not the right way to go about pushing forward your issues is to leave the party and go and join another party. I think you stay within the party and you fight for what you believe in. That's how our parliament works and how our politics works.
What was the deal with Bob Spink, who lost at the last election, who was describing himself as a UKIP MP and next he's not, he was an independent. What was going on there?
I know, it's very complicated and tough to keep up. Bob was a Tory MP. Mm. He lost the whip in the Tory party, had a great big row with his local association. Mm. He said, right, to hell with that, I'll sit as UKIP. So for 18 months or so in the last parliament, he sat as UKIP, but he then decided he'd be better off fighting the general election as an independent. And he came within 3,000 votes of winning that Castle Point seat as an independent. So, yeah, you know, and that's the other problem with defectors, of course, that once somebody's defected once, the trouble is it's quite easy for them to defect
again. Yeah, but I say to you again, I said it, and apologies, Tony, for talking over you a little bit there, but Winston Churchill defected.
Winston Churchill, you know, was a unique... He is sui generis. There really is no other politician that was like him. And to be fair, I don't think he defected over thinking and making a calculation that he could win his seat. I'm not an expert on Churchill, so I'm not sure. I think what you'd be seeing with Tory MPs is them making a calculation that they'd be better off holding on to their seat, saving their skin, if they defected to UKIP. And I think that's what I object to.
Yeah, I agree with that. And actually, I think what's really interesting next May the 22nd is actually not so much the European elections. What is really interesting are the council elections. There are between 5,000 and 6,000 seats up for grabs next year. Now, if UKIP was able to win 150 seats under first past the post in the English counties, we could possibly win a very large number of council seats next year. And if we do that in clusters in constituencies, that, I think, is when the calculation for some sitting MPs could well be we'd be better off as UKIP.
All right, then, yeah. Nigel, let me ask you directly now. In the event that you won a number of seats at the next general election and there were a hung parliament situation, which of the main parties, if any, would you be prepared to enter into coalition with?
Oh, that's easy. Any of them. Provided we got a free and fair referendum a fortnight Thursday.
Right, so that would be your die-in-a-ditch deal.
That'd be the one we start with, yeah.
All right, but you've told me that David Cameron's been dishonest on the topic of Europe, so why would you trust him?
Which is why any deal before the election with Cameron looks well nigh impossible, and he's pretty much ruled it out himself already. But post an election, you know, I mean, I wouldn't...
Well, sorry, you say post an election it's easy, but you look at Lords reforms, that hasn't happened. Whether or not you agree with Lords reforms, by the way, but there are countless examples of where deals have not been delivered.
Well, that's why I say slightly flippantly, it would have to be a fortnight Thursday. The referendum would have to be... A specific date would have to be set, and it would not need to be, in my view, too far in the distance.
I think a better comparison, Sean, would actually probably be the alternative vote. The Lib Dems went in demanding a referendum on the alternative vote. They got the referendum. They lost quite badly. But I think Lords reform is a little bit more complicated because it just requires parliamentary processes. I think if you're asking for a referendum, that's a pretty easy and obvious thing for a government to deliver. And then the conversation comes down to the wording of the referendum and the date of the referendum.
Absolutely. Chatting with Nigel Farage in studio, guest of the week for here, also Tony Grew, parliamentary editor of Politics Home. Both excellent follows. Nigel _Farage for Nigel on Twitter and Eyes to the Right, A-Y-E-S to the Right for Tony Grew. Question on Twitter. Ben Walker, 17-year-old UKIP member, tweeted us and he says, as a member, I'm wondering what the party's position is on same-sex marriage, given that it's legalised. Will we drop it?
I don't think this debate's finished. We've already seen elements in the Sikh community who are saying we had better stop doing civil blessings because we may not be able to confine that to heterosexual couples, and they're very worried about it. I think it'll be a very short hop before Peter Tatchell takes a case to Strasbourg now that says that if gay people can get married, then heterosexual people should be able to have civil partnerships. I don't think this is finished yet. My objection to gay marriage is that all the while we're under the auspices of the ECHR, it could well lead to elements of the faith communities being made to conduct ceremonies that they find anathema. So I think this is unfinished business.
Tony?
I think that's absolute nonsense. I think there's absolutely no way in which the European Court can compel religious organisations to do what they want. I have a slightly different take on this because, I was brought up as a Roman Catholic. So, you know, the Roman Catholic Church will not at any point be conducting marriages. That's the point. That's the end of the conversation.
There is no other
conversation to be had.
And if that
requires the Church to opt out of the fact that they can legal marriages in this country but not in a lot of European countries, I think this is where the complication comes in with the UK, is because we allow religious organisations to conduct legal wedding ceremonies. Personally, I believe that shouldn't be the case.
Nigel, the difficulty...
Church marriage.
The difficulty is particularly an Anglican problem. in that we have an established state church, a state religion in this country, and if a registry office is conducting a gay marriage, then it is not impossible that Strasbourg could judge that if one part of the state conducts marriage, another part of the state should do so. Otherwise, the state has discriminated, and I think the Anglican Church faces potentially a real problem with Strasbourg here.
Yeah, I do agree with that point, actually. I think Nigel has hit on the exact point, which is the fact that we have an established church is where problems will arise. Which is why, to be fair, the government had to jump through several hoops and produce this thing called the quadruple locks to try and ensure that the state church would not be conducting same-sex marriages. I think the most likely outcome will probably be disestablishment. And I think that's an unintended consequence of same-sex marriage may be a loosening of the bond.
Let's shift through these questions just in the interest of time. Alan Hemless has tweeted us. He says, when will you introduce plain packaging on cigarettes, Nigel?
I won't. I like that my particular brand of cigarettes that I've been buying for some years. If they bring in plain packets, I will just have to buy a false packet to put them in. Can't government just go away and let us live our lives and make our
own
choices?
Would you really do that? You'd actually get a packet?
Oh, yeah.
Would you?
I've got that planned already.
Well, even if you're going to get arrested?
They can do what they like to me. I don't care. No, I mean, look, you know, we all know smoking's not good for us, but I am sick to death of this nannying state telling me what I should drink, eat and smoke. You know, my own view, and that we all make our own choices, my own view is that we should enjoy our lives to the full and do what we want to do.
OK, so another question here. Sarah Manchester asks, who out of Nick Clegg, David Cameron and Ed Miliband would you most like to share a non-working pint with and why?
Nick Clegg.
Why?
Well, I served with him for 5 years in Brussels. I think he's a perfectly nice guy. And I think he would
effective
be...
Effective politician?
Well, look, he's taken the Liberal Democrats into a position where he's become a deputy prime minister and they're in coalition government for the first time since the war. Whichever way you look at that, that's pretty successful. I would socialise and have more of a laugh with Nick Clegg than I would with the other two.
Tony, we've done pints at different points through through various parliamentary functions with each of the leaders. What's your answer to the same question?
Nigel Farage.
No, he wasn't an option. He might be at the election, debatably.
I tell you what, it'll be a much longer session with me.
I know, I've done one in the past. Out of those three, who do you find most engaging personally, Tony?
I don't find any of them engaging. I think that probably Ed Miliband, actually. Ed, I quite like talking to Ed. I find him very easy to talk to. I find the Prime Minister quite stiff. Nick Clegg always looks like he's got the troubles of the world on his shoulders. So maybe a therapy session rather than a pint would be better for him.
All right, Tony, can you give us your advice lastly just to David Cameron? It has to be David Cameron, really. You can extend it if you want. How do they handle a problem like Farage?
Well, I think what you need to do is some of the things the Prime Minister has already done, which is try and smarten up and tighten up your message on Europe. But I think the problem that the Prime Minister has is he still looks like an insider. And that is the thing that the public hate most. If something seems to happen to Prime Ministers once they go off to their first European summit, they appear to have come back brainwashed. And Margaret Thatcher was brilliant at portraying herself being tough Europe and pretty much against the European project, while in fact doing things like signing the Single European Act. It's as much about perception as policy, so I think he needs to change his image a bit and be a bit more of a rebel and a bad boy.
Hear, hear with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo. Sign up for your free account now.
And you can do that at audioboo.fm. Now, if you're not familiar with Audio Boo, if you're listening to this integrated on Twitter as it is, it's a fantastic service where you can share your audio. It's not just professionally produced work or the BBC and LBC, various people who partner with Audio Boo. It's a social media platform where you can actually share your views and your opinions with anyone and everybody who's out there. It's like a talking Twitter, if you like. Back to Nigel Farage, studio guest of the week for the Hear Hear Show, UK Independence Party leader. You've had a few run-ins with the BBC, haven't you?
Oh, goodness me, yes.
Should we listen to one of them?
Let's go on.
Looking at the Times this morning, you're quoted as saying, turning up in Scotland, telling everyone how much you love Scotland and what a big part of your life it's been.
Rubbish. I've never said a single thing like that.
Well, let me just finish putting the quote to you. Telling everyone how much I love Scotland and what a big part of my life it's been, how sincere I am, it would all have been a lot of rubbish, wouldn't it? And isn't that the problem? UKIP isn't part of Scottish political debate in any meaningful way, and you know very little of Scotland or the politics of Scotland.
I'm sensing similar hatred from this line of questioning that I got on the streets yesterday in Edinburgh. We are the only UK-wide political party. We're the only party with representation in Stormont. We have representation from Wales in the European Parliament. We clearly have become quite strong in England, and we intend to start mounting serious campaigns in Scotland. No other party in UK politics even attempts to do all of those things.
And remind me how many elected representatives you have in Scotland?
Absolutely none, but rather more than the BBC do. And, you know, we could have had this interview in England a couple of years, although I wouldn't have met with such hatred as I'm getting from your questions. And frankly, I've had enough of this interview. Goodbye.
Well, you did throw your toys out of the pram a bit.
No,
but
I was very calm.
It was a hostile line of questioning.
I was very calm. And, yeah. And you know, that line of questioning went on for minute after minute after minute. There was not even an attempt at objectivity.
No.
And really, what he was saying was, you turned up in Scotland, you were met with violent rebellion, and you deserved it, didn't you? And I mean, imagine if Peter Mandelson got off a train in Ashford in Kent and a group of my supporters surrounded him and screamed abuse at him. I mean, I would have to spend the next month apologising for the behaviour of UKIP supporters. And yet, the BBC seemed to think it was fine. And Alex, and more extraordinarily, Alex Salmond refused to condemn the behaviour. I found the whole thing unedified.
I would say to you, actually, to be fair, I don't think it's the job of the BBC to defend or actually attack the actions of thugs, which they were. But I will go as far as to say that, you know, the line of questioning would be fine, but I'll agree with you that the manner seemed just a little bit, contravening of BBC editorial guidelines.
Well,
do I say
supposed
that?
To be a public service broadcaster.
You can ask questions. I mean, the point he made was actually fair enough, the idea that in Scotland many would regard UKIP to be a political irrelevance. So it's not necessarily the question, it was the tone of the voice. Is that
you
what
you know nothing of Scotland. I mean, that was the thing that really got to me.
Yeah.
You know, and
it was ad hominem as opposed to sort of objective, really.
Yes, and it was the line, it was exactly the same line the SNP were putting out. Yeah,
you spoke about hatred.
Yeah.
Do you see that as a BBC thing? Do you see it as a Scottish thing? Where do you view that coming from?
Well, certainly what I met with in the streets of Edinburgh was hatred. I mean, real hatred. I mean, quite astonishing. And it's interesting, you know, because this is what nationalism can do. A little bit of nationalism generally makes people feel happier about who they are and where they live. But extremes of nationalism, as we've seen in history, can become very, very unpleasant. Salmond has dominated the whole Scottish landscape. And he's taken much of the media.
He's a very clever politician, and actually, in common with yourself, it has to be said, Nigel, he's a very straight talker.
Yes, he is. But I'm afraid that there are a significant number of youngsters in Lowland Scotland who now are developing an attitude towards the English that is deeply unhealthy.
That's an interesting point. If anybody's got comments on that, we've got a channel here on Audio Boo. It's called Have I Got Boots For You? So your comments on that and also your views on the issue of Europe more generally. What next for Nigel Farage after UKIP?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I suspect I've got the busiest 2 years of my life ever coming up, which actually after the last two seems difficult to even think about. But, there's some very, very major challenges, some big hurdles. I think that the other parties will try and make life very hard for us. I suspect they'll go for playing the player and not the ball. It's not going to be
easy.
That's
what politics is about now, that's the problem.
Sadly, yes. It really is. But I think that there are a growing number of ordinary voters out there from across the spectrum, and we forget how many old Labour voters are now turning up voting UKIP in by-elections and in the local elections recently for the counties. And I think we've got a serious chance of getting good representation in Westminster in 2015 and possibly holding that balance of power. That's what I'm going to fight for over the next 2 years. And to be honest with you, that challenge is so huge, I can't see beyond that at the moment.
We did invite the Conservatives on to debate with you. They said it's just not something that they do.
What? End a debate?
Well, in this particular scenario, the idea of the rise of UKIP.
Well, that's up to them. I mean, I think they are in the most awful flap over UKIP. They don't know what to do.
How do they bridge the gap? How do they get on side with you?
Well, they've got to change their leader, obviously.
Really? So, but wait a minute, you were contradicting what you said earlier, which is you could do a deal with David Cameron.
I did. I said I couldn't. I said pre-election, it's almost impossible to consider there being a deal.
Yeah, but you're saying you could do a deal if he's still the leader. Are you now saying...
Well, what I said was, if he was the biggest party after an election, and we were in a position to get the British people a full, free and fair referendum, then that would be different.
Grant that. OK, so they're here and now. Change their leader.
I think they've got to, because you've got a Conservative leader who pushed through gay marriage, with it being a priority, despite the fact most Tory voters didn't want it. You've got a leader so dedicated to despoiling Britain with wind turbines that he even put one in his house in Notting Hill. You've got the leader of a Conservative Party who, at the same time as sacking 5,000 soldiers, is making sure our foreign aid budget is the highest in the Western world.
Yeah, but that's by international agreement, isn't it? And I guess that would be part of the issue that you'd
have.
Yeah,
but everybody else rats on it and we don't. And you've got a Conservative Party leader who, for 8 years as leader, has said, let's not bang on about Europe, and has now done a U-turn, which is barely credible. You've got a Conservative Party leader who has been very happy with open-door immigration, so much so that he welcomes 28 million Romanians and Bulgarians on January the 1st next year, that if they want, they can come on down and come to Britain in unlimited numbers. And I'm going to make this prediction. The number of people that come from Romania and Bulgaria next year could be the single most important factor in the general election of 2015.
It could be. I'll tell you what, I will say, just as a point of balance, the Romanians I've come into contact with when I've been in Bucharest, for example, they're not the Romanian gangs of criminals that many of us are used to in London. I know that's besides the point that you're making, but it's a point I think we should make. Let's, Nigel, just before letting you go, let's just quickly turn to the idea of David Cameron, if you like. Do you have any conversations with him?
No.
You don't at all? Do you think you ought to be?
No. I don't.
TV debates. Come on, we've
spoken
about this before.
That's different. Well, look,
Do you think you deserve a place? Because at the end of the day, you're not yet, given the electoral history, one of the three main parties.
The next national election in this country is, as Tony pointed out earlier, not in 2015. It's on May the 22nd next year. Every single voter...
Yeah, but the TV debate isn't before then. Every we'll be talking single, in the run-up to the general election.
Every single voter in Britain has a vote on May the 22nd next year. Mm. We should have national TV debates ahead of the European elections next year.
You'll be lucky on that one. There were something like 176 clauses in the general election one with the three party leaders. Linton Crosby, can't let you go without asking you about this situation. Awful lot of argument about lobbying and David Cameron, you know, sort of failing to say whether he'd spoken to him about the subject of plane packaging. It's interesting, just to recap for here listeners, he's being asked not... Did he lobby? Because the answer he keeps giving, and it is a very politician answer, I'm afraid, is that he's never lobbied me on anything. The question is, have you discussed it? He's a Conservative policy advisor. But Linton Crosby has directly said, no, I've never spoken to the Prime Minister on this subject. So why this answer from the Prime Minister?
Well, I find that very difficult to believe.
Really?
Well, if Linton Crosby, having done business with the big tobacco companies in the past, has not said, look, Prime Minister, you need to know something. I may potentially be slightly compromised over this. So, you know, you need to know this in case you're questioned about it. I find it impossible to think that Crosby and he would not have had a conversation about it.
So you... Wow, I mean, that's quite big. Saying that you don't believe
his version.
If
somebody who worked for me was potentially going to compromise me over... Even though I'm not suggesting wrongdoing or anything like that, but just in the spirit of disclosure and knowing what is going on, if somebody worked for me in that situation had not told me about it and had not discussed it with me, I think I'd have to fire them.
Do you think David Cameron should fire Linton Crosby?
Well, if Linton Crosby hasn't declared to Mr. Cameron that he previously had lobbying experience with big tobacco companies, something is very seriously wrong.
Well, he's a man who likes to answer a question directly. We're very grateful for that on the Hear Hear show. You can follow Nigel on Twitter at Nigel_Farage. Now, he's a very busy man, but if you're lucky enough to catch him in the right moment, he might even fire your tweet back. You can follow us on at Hear Hear Show on Twitter, or indeed myself. I've never actually plugged my own Twitter on here, so let's do that now. It's at Sean Dilley. This has been episode 14. Thank you very much for listening. This has been Hear Hear, and this is Audio Boo.
Hear Hear with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.